Welcome to Talking Music. I'm Cynthia Hines, and I'll be your host today. I'm joined in the studio by three other DJs, and we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about the blues and what the blues means to us. But first, let's hear from our participants.
Hello, this is Father Elk.
This is DJ Hurricane.
And this is Todd, co-host of Blues and Other Colors every Blues Day.
With me, Cynthia. So, all of four of us DJs in the room today play folk, blues, soul, the whole gamut of that kind of music. We want to spend a little time talking about what is it? What is the blues to us? So, Hurricane, why don't you start?
This is something that I've been thinking about for over four decades, so no small amount of thought has gone into this. It's not a real pressing matter for me to identify things like this. What is the blues? But I kind of noodle things like this around my mind, and sometimes it occurs to me, what does it do for me? And I think a good lead into this will be, what exactly is the blues?
All right, so what is the blues to you? How would you define it?
So I think it's important to keep in mind that in the early days of blues being constructed as a musical form in the realm of popular music, when people like John Lomax and later Alan Lomax were going around and asking the people who played blues what blues is, how would they define it, they weren't defining it in terms of a musical sound. They were defining it in terms of feeling.
Hardship, waking, getting up in the morning, 4 days, and then lay down at night, way about 9, 10 o'clock, feeding horses and milking cows, driving up the sheep and feeding up and calling up the hogs every morning. So when the people in them times, they'd be sad and feeling bad, and they'd sing blues. They didn't know how to sing nothing else, but that old feeling come to them. That's what they call the blues, that old feeling. I don't guess they know what they had to say, but they began to sing.
It was always described by those early practitioners as the blues is when your woman gets up and leaves and you don't know why. The blues is waking up one morning to find that, you know, your shoes are missing. There's another man creeping out your back door. You've lost your job. The blues were always defined as experiences rather than sound. So I think that, you know, if we're going to try to define it now in 2013, we have to at least account for that or appreciate the fact that from its origins, it wasn't thought of as being a sound. It was thought of as being a shared experience and shared emotions and just a form of expression more than an oral element, I guess.
Todd?
Well, you know, I don't think very much about what the blues is. This probably dovetails well with what Father Elk was just saying. The blues for me has been always an experience. The first record that I ever bought as a kid was All Around the World by Little Willie John. Little Willie John was killed in prison long time ago, and All Around the World turned into Grits Ain't Groceries. What I recognized, you know, sometimes when people talk about drug experiences of various kinds, they talk about having a drug of choice. The idea being that if you ever experience that drug, you know instantly that you have some special relationship with it. And that's the experience that I had with the blues when I was 12 years old. And it's the experience that has continued on. It can be defined a number of ways. And it's kind of a fool's errand in a sense. But it's an experience to me that did something. It turned my brain on. I resonated with it somehow naturally. And that's still true. As we all know, there are many kinds of blues, but there are some kinds of blues that just resonate with me. I have an experience with it the first time I hear it. That isn't true of all types of blues.
You know, there's a great clip of Son House during an interview being asked what the blues is. And Son House was probably born, what, the turn of the century?
Sure.
So he's been gone quite a long time. But he was there at the very kind of the very beginning of the blues as we know it, the modern blues. And he was complaining about kids nowadays, talking about this blues that and that blues this. And in his mind, what he says about it is, it's that which consists of between a male and a female.
Ain't but one kind of blues. And that consists between male and female that's in love. In love. Blues. B-L-U-E-S. Blues.
It's a way of expressing suffering that resonates with almost everyone, seems like.
Sunhouse does talk about the blues as a musical form rather than just as feeling. He addresses, you know, the component of it being a shared feeling of suffering, of sorrow, of struggle. You know, as much as we and a lot of people may not like to define blues, he had a very particular definition of it.
The real old blues don't call for no jumping.
You don't need to go to jumping. That's not the blues.
Right. So, jump this and jump that.
Right. So even throughout the long history of blues and you know, the evolution of it, there have been some like very specific structures of it and ideas of it as a musical form.
Hurricane?
Just like Todd, at the age of 17, my introduction to music outside of Dion and the Belmonts and Tommy James and the Shondells was in New York City. The first 2 weeks I was there, this band got up on a stage at this place, and it was Paul Butterfield Blues Band with Bishop and Bloomfield and Butterfield and Sam Lay and Jerome Arnold on bass. And I quickly figured out, but only because of the title of the name of their band, that I was listening to the blues, but it flat blew me away. So I go back to what Todd said. It was a feeling that it gave me. Now, I think back in the day of Sunhouse, it's very appropriate for a number of those early blues men and women to define, this is what it is. It's X number of bars, X number of whatever. But as the 60s hit and all that British invasion and what was going on with Janis Joplin and people like that, they were taking their inspiration out of all that early work. The Stones is a perfect example. Mm-hmm. They're called the best rock and roll band ever.
Which is true.
I call them the best blues band ever, because if you look at their first three albums, it's all those old blues tunes. I think it is good to have a basic understanding of what folks early on defined it, but I'm with Todd. It's a fool's errand to start fine-tuning your appreciation, saying, no, that's rock, or that's country and folk, or that's jazz, etc. It's just melded into this beautiful flowing river of music here in the second decade of the 21st century.
But you know, I'm amazed that we could go this far into this discussion without anyone saying African American. Mm-hmm. This music is embedded in a culture, and people talk about it in various ways, that it's American music, and maybe that's not a fair thing to say, because it just becomes more of an academic and historical discussion. The blues certainly is historical by its very nature, and it's historical to this day. And we talk about performers based on often who they performed with. You know, somebody learned the harp under Sonny Boy. Well, was that the real Sonny Boy, or was that Rice Miller? And so you can have those kinds of discussions, but I think what's important, especially as we sit in this room being all white folk, we're into the black culture and you can't then help, when you're trying to talk about the blues, you can't help but talk about the connection between the blues and the field hollers and all the communication that was going on, and what happened with the drums and didn't happen with the drums, and what went on in Congo Square and what was stopped, and didn't all this music, in a sense, come out of West Africa, and wasn't it all wrapped up in the spirituals? And all of that is true. I mean, as we talk about Son House and what he said about the music, Son House was a preacher. And part of what happened with Son House was that in the early part of the evening, he preached the blues, and then everybody passed out, and he woke them up at 5 a.m, and then he preached the gospel. and that's the history of that and how he approached the music. He was made crazy by the conflict, I mean literally by the conflict between religious music and the devil's music and blues music. And I think you just have to, when the Fisk Jubilee Choir decided that in order to save themselves and black folk in the South, they had to divulge spiritual music, that was a very big deal. And had a great deal of influence on what followed.
Little David, play on your harp. Hallelujah, hallelujah. Little David, play on your harp. Hallelujah, little David, play on your harp. Hallelujah, hallelujah. Little David, play on your harp.
Todd, I guess I could pick up from what you were sort of saying there, because as I was thinking about that question early on, I was thinking about myself as a teenager discovering blues music, which happened not too long ago, really, compared to, the other histories in the room. I was thinking that early on, the blues to me meant an alternative experience. It meant, and this is not new, this is something that happened to, you know, record fiends in the 60s and happened to people getting into rock and roll in the 50s. First hearing this music for me was a complete escape door from the sheltered, very middle America, very white existence that I was living and, you know, arguably continue to live. That was what it was for me. I mean, more so than just sort of, you know, a sharing of this and identifying with this feeling of pain and sorrow, which certainly I had at the time and will continue to have as all humans do. It was a way to be outside of my world for a second and experience a world that was at the time completely alien to me. And, you know, maybe less so growing up in the 1990s, but it was still a keyhole to another culture, another existence that I wanted to feel.
Which is exactly where the Rolling Stones and Butterfield and Bloomfield and Elvin Bishop, same story. You know,
right.
They were really young white guys that went, oh, my God, what
yeah,
is
Yeah, coming
this?
Down from the north side of
yeah.
Chicago to the south side.
Right.
And peering through the curtains at Junior Wells playing the harmonica. That's how Paul Butterfield got his start.
I love how many of the black blues musician got their start by being a little kid peering in the windows of the honky-tonk or yeah. the brothel or whatever, being tiny little kids, but they had to see what was going on with that music.
Now, the word suffering came up, and I think that's very appropriate, because and the word the place name West Africa came up. For both the jazz and blues, the common accepted wisdom is this is true American music. I think that this music came out of Africa. It's not pure American music. It has been developed into a particular unique American music, but we need to recognize the roots. Secondly, the word suffering. I think that the blues to the people who invented it, who took it further from Africa, was a particular cultural life reaction to the situation they were in, i.e. slavery, racism, segregation, etc. I also am very much of a believer that to understand the blues, you got to live the blues. And I think as a young white kid in New York at the age of 16, I unconsciously, after seeing B.B. King and Paul Butterfield and just on and on and on, I embarked on this Jack Kerouacian quest to live the blues and purposely sought out situations that allowed me to explore the blues very, very deeply.
Cooper Union Cafeteria, late cold March afternoon. The street, Third Avenue, is cobbled, cold, desolate with trolley tracks.
Are you just saying you drank a lot?
I drank a lot, and we'll leave the other. But there's a certain joy that comes out of the blues. If you've got the blues, you know, and the rent is due and this, that, and the other thing, and you put that on, put on some blues, it actually picks you up.
True.
Whereas the common understanding by people who don't have an appreciation of the blues is, oh, I don't want to hear that depressing music.
Many, many years ago, back at the old station, this is probably 12, 15 years ago, Todd and I were doing a show, and a gentleman, back in those days, you could just walk right into the studio, which happened often. And this guy walked into the studio and took a look at us and said, "Y'all don't look so down and out to me." He was deeply disappointed that we were not rougher around the edges, I guess. We didn't have the appearance of suffering enough for his taste.
Your issue was, what does the blues do to us or for us? Is that
what does it mean to you? You know, what is it? What is it?
Okay, I think in the same way that you can't get very far into this discussion without saying African-American, I don't think you can get very far into this discussion without saying soul. Because Agreed. I think that people who value the blues, and when I say value, I mean people who resonate to this kind of music, have some quality that I'm willing to call soul. And I don't know exactly how you define that, but one of the ways I would back into it is we've all heard white boys singing the blues who can't do it. And if you start to think about what's wrong, you know, what's missing there, what isn't happening, for me, I end up saying something like soul. You know, the guy is a good musician, he's technically competent, he knows the music, and it doesn't click. It doesn't work. And it's that thing, soul, and it has something to do, in my mind, with that intertwining of spiritual music and the devil's music and the fact that this resonates for some people. I mean, said simply, the blues makes me feel good. It doesn't matter what kind of blues. Some blues make me feel better than others, but I have that experience of resonating. I have that experience of connecting. You know, we had at KVNF a number of years ago a really fun opportunity when Dion came out. You mentioned Dion earlier, Hurricane. Dion came out with this blues record that was magnificent. And we fell in love with it and started to play it way ahead of the release date. And we forced, out of New York, we forced the early release of Dion's blues record, which I thought was just marvelous. But what Dion said was, because the issue was, what Dion and the Belmonts, what are you doing a blues record? And he said, look, when I grew up, there wasn't rock and roll. Of course I'm a blues man. That's what was there. Rock and roll didn't exist. And, I think I would confess that I've had a similar experience. It filled that hole in my soul when I was an adolescent.
Dion was my favorite singer back in 63, 62, you know, dancing close with your girlfriend and stuff like that. And when he came out with that CD, it just blew me away. And I was so happy because it was a perfect illustration of what you just said. A rock and roller, white rock and roller. They weren't even rock and rollers. It was whatever, rock. Comes 40 years later with just a brilliant blues CD. Now, you mentioned soul, and I don't think you were talking about the Temptations or the Four Tops or whatever. There's an aspect of soul in whether you're talking blues, jazz, whatever. And what the Hurricane calls it is fire in the belly. The difference between the white boys who try to play the blues and the white boys who can play the blues, in my mind, is the latter have the fire in the belly, and that comes over very, very strong in their music. And that's what attracts me.
Do you think that the fire in the belly also is an earnest fire? Because to me, there are a lot of people, regardless of race, who would try to play the blues and who fail. And for me, a lot of the time, it has more to do with not necessarily they have an intensity of soul or passion, but there's a lack of earnesty. I can listen to somebody play blues in a very subdued way. There's some artists that I'm into that almost play a psychedelic form of blues, you know, things that just have tinges of it. And while it may not sound like four-bar blues, it may not sound like Robert Johnson or B.B. King or any of these people, I identify it as something being blues, but I more importantly identify it as having an earnesty.
What I think the dividing line is a dividing line within the entire human race when they're listening to music. The very nature of music and the changes that happen instantaneously and things like that, everything that makes this beautiful music is a highly emotional type of response. So you've got the cognitive thinkers who can never seem to get a hold of this thing called music. They like it, but they don't feel it.
Yeah.
And then I'm sitting with four people, and I know about 1,000 others who are on the other side, who when those first few notes start, it's hitting them right in the gut.
Yeah.
And I've always looked at my collection of music by that one thing. Does this particular group, does this particular individual have that fire in the belly? And if they do, they've passed the Hurricane's particular dividing line between good music and music that is less good, I guess.
I'm Cynthia Hines. You're listening to Talking Music here on KVNF. I'm joined here by Father Elk, DJ Hurricane, and Todd, my co-host of Blues and Other Colors, and we're talking about the blues, what it is, what it isn't, what it means to each of us. And up till now, we've mostly been talking about the history of blues. What I want us to do now is talk about that individual experience of the blues. So for each of you, if y'all could name one little thing that really does it for you when it comes to blues music, for example, that really famous Elmore James lick, especially right before Yonder's Wall, that thing just makes me go squishy. I just get weak in the knees. So, Father Elk, do you have something like that? Something that makes you go all squishy?
It's a hard question.
you stopped him in his tracks.
It's an extremely hard question, but I have to say that the most enjoyable experience of blues music that I probably can think of is R.L. Burnside, when he's playing. He's usually playing somewhat out of tune. He's playing very loudly. You can hear his hand and his finger and maybe like a ring on his finger hitting the wood of the acoustic guitar. And it, you know, at some parts it sounds like total crap. I'm going where you be. I mean, it's just very rough. And for me, listening to RL play, it's like those weird little moments where just this imperfection sort of comes up in his playing in the middle of these very like driving, droning grooves that really does it for me. I mean, I'll like rewind, you know, a few seconds to listen to the way that, like, you know, that finger sort of hits one of the strings on accident or something like that. Just that ragged nature of it is really what gets me.
Like the thread of dissonance, it sounds like you're saying.
Yes, yeah.
How about you, Hurricane?
I no longer believe in genres. There are no boundaries.
There never have been with you, Hurricane.
And Saturday, I did a kind of a special with Carlos Cocker and Morrison, and that's all I played. And each one of those, I introduced them as musicians, soul men, rhythm and blues men, and jazz men. And each one of those has some modicum of that basic blues in them that has influenced their work ever since. And you get into some of that interstellar, intergalactic Santana music of the 80s. And it's hard to call it blues.
Yeah.
But there's riffs in there that are so hardcore blues that you can't believe it. With the circus mind that's running around. Butterflies and zebras. And so I would say that the stuff that makes me soft and squishy is 480 mile an hour blues.
Electric. You're talking electric.
Buddy Loan Me a Dime with, I think it was Dwayne. Or immediately later, some really soft, sweet, bitter, biting stuff by Etta James.
Oh. Didn't I make you feel
like you were the only man? The dichotomy between the two, they all lead to the same place, if you know what I'm trying to say there.
I think I do. How about you, Todd?
This kind of comes down to what the blues isn't, because what I have to say to start is that I've never in my lifetime been a jazz aficionado for various reasons. And my understanding of jazz, which, you know, may not be anyone else's, but that it tends to be and historically was a fusion between the West African music and European music, whereas blues was the fusion between the West African music and the spiritual music. I think somewhat in relation to my feelings about jazz, I never was interested in jam bands. In fact, I would go the other way from jam bands. And I find myself now at this point in my life being deeply attracted to what's called blues rock. And I'm talking about, you know, initially the Allmans, and then you go to various incarnations of Warren Haynes and The Dead and Government Mule and Tedeschi Trucks. And what does it for me at this point, paradoxically, from my earlier history, is that whole jam band issue where people go into what they talk about as a zone. And part of my respect for Stevie Ray, and when you listen to people talk about him, especially right after his death, the thing they say consistently is that he went into a zone. And when he was in there, just miraculous things happened. And when those people like Hendrix or Vaughn talk about that experience, they talk about it as a mystical experience. I just went there, or I just go there, however that gets said. And it's that zone that now for me is exemplified most probably by that blues, Southern blues rock. But, you know, Duane Allman talked about that zone decades ago before his death. That does something for me. When Warren Haynes, Government Mule, gets into that zone, I'm gone, but it's remedial. It helps.
Let's just talk a little bit about who we believe, who our favorite torchbearers are. Who do we think is carrying the blues in its essence forward? Father Elk?
Well, most instinctively, and I hate to say this at this point because they're such pop musicians and I've grown to have such complicated and more so bordering on hateful feelings towards them. I would have to say that the Black Keys have done a lot of work.
Hey, now, baby. Let the run.
I think that at this point they are complete rock stars. I mean, you can, you know, look at any of their PR materials and they're rock stars at this point. But
they were on Stephen Colbert just a couple nights ago.
Exactly. They're international, they're famous, they're big news, they're moneymakers. But in the early days, I mean, you know, those basement recordings on the big come up. That was raw stuff. I would have to commend them for being a torchbearer, not necessarily in terms of the sound of blues being progressed and evolved, but definitely in terms of just the education of the blues of being spread around to people who would have never experienced it. I mean, what other, you know, top 40, they're probably top 40 at this point, what other huge mainstream rock band in the past 10 years do you know of that has recorded a complete tribute album to Junior Kimbrough? I mean, you know, that alone, just that work that they did was a service to blues music in general, you know, if not something to progress the music or to carry the music forward, just to the history and the legacy of it, that record alone is valuable.
We get together now, darling. Todd?
Well, you know, it makes me think about a conversation with Candy. You mentioned Junior Kimbrough and R.L. Burnside. We're talking about North Mississippi Hill Country Blues and the discussion I had with Candy about the North Mississippi All-Stars, which she was putting in rock and roll as a genre. And we had this discussion about the fact that that's Hill Country Blues. That is blues music. At that kind of rough, raw level. For me, the people who, and that involves history that, you know, maybe we don't want to get into in terms of the repression of drumming. A lot of those drums went to the North Mississippi Hill Country, and that's why a lot of that music has a different flavor to it. The Otha Turner Band, you know, that's a whole, that's drum and fife. So when I look at who are the heirs to that and who has brought that forward, I come on Warren Haynes. And anybody who listens to my music and looks at my clothes knows I take that to Warren Haynes. And he's a figure that you can know from the Almonds, from Government Mule, from Grateful Dead. He takes that modern interpretation of blues and soul to the very top.
Hurricane? Who are your torchbearers then?
My torchbearers now, I'll try to narrow it down, Sarah Earnhardt.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been a real fan of female blues shouters, even more than male blues shouters, the Etta Jameses, the Ruthie Fosters. But there's a new generation coming up, and this is only a few of them. Sarah Earnhardt, Cassie Taylor, Anna Popovich, about whom we've had numerous discussions. And then I hear Clapton and Santana playing with people like Wayne Shorter from the jazz idiom.
We were talking earlier about soul, how important, not the genre, if you will, but being soulful. And I think Susan Tedeschi has got to be the most soulful female singer, vocalist of our time.
Ever dreamed of. And maybe you can drive your Hummer down your gold-plated streets with your dove, yeah. Of all the things you ought to buy,
so some of the most important torchbearers, I think, right now, here in 2013 for blues are record labels. Record labels like Mississippi Records, Dust to Digital, Tompkins Square, 50 Miles of Elbow Room is another boutique label. These people are doing the work that has been done before by people like John Lomax, Alan Lomax, George Mitchell, and archiving, documenting, and just consistently reminding us of the history of this music and where it came from. And, for example, Mississippi Records reissued some of the Southern Journey Alan Lomax recordings on vinyl. Instant new audience. I mean, instant new audience. Young kids at the record stores seeing this for the first time going, what in the hell is this? This looks crazy. You know, having that same experience we talked about that has happened for decades and decades and decades. And that wouldn't continue to happen if you only had, you know, the rounder CDs on the shelves. That's not going to grab people's attention. So there are people who are working on, you know, you might even say the academic side, in exposing this music to newer and newer audiences and keeping it fresh in people's minds But for me, the people who are doing that work, like I said, have a long history of doing that work. Folklorists, musicologists, whatever you want to call them, that have been bringing this music into the popular realm since its creation. For me, that work they're doing is part of my love and hate relationship with the blues. We can't talk about the blues, I feel, without acknowledging that somewhere down the line in the history of this music, there has been some appropriation of African-American culture. I mean, there's been some blending of it with mainstream white American culture, but there's also been some appropriation. And it starts from the moment that, you know, John Lomax is having Lead Belly dress in prison stripes for these private concerts mm-hmm. at, you know, fancy dinners in Austin, Texas. I mean, there is a history of that there. And it's a complicated history, just like the history of the United States in general is, but I think it's something that we have to acknowledge. You know, it's less of an issue now, but there was a time, you know, there in the 50s and into the 60s when, you know, these budding record collectors and archivists who we so revere now, like Joe Broussard, were going door to door and you know, in poor neighborhoods and knocking on the door and saying, hey, do you have any records? And digging through and taking this stuff for, you know, $5 that created their personal fortune years later.
Right.
There's a potential problem of cultural appropriation. I won't say misappropriation, but appropriation nonetheless.
You could say misappropriation.
You can say that.
Pay Bo Diddley.
I was just going to say it's the Pay Bo Diddley syndrome.
There's a song by Mighty Mo Rogers, The Boy Who Stole the Blues. Mighty Mo being this fairly radical Berkeley black keyboard musician in the 60s, 70s. The gentleman that Mighty Mo was talking about was Elvis Presley, the boy who stole the blues.
People tried to warn him, don't go across those tracks. He said, blues was over that. Mystery train will bring me back. Now he sang with passion. Once he got those blues, shaking up the 50s, breaking off the rules. He's the boy who stole the blues, and the blues made him pay. It's sin, fame, and punish him.
Very seriously meant that.
You might blame Sam Phillips.
I was
going to
say it's
too,
Sam
like,
Phillips
well,
who stole
you've,
the blues,
you've given
man.
Me that, but I because believe everybody's accountable, regardless of the number of painkillers they have in their body. Like Elvis. But did Keith Richard steal the blues? No, he went up to Chess Records and walked in the door, and there was a guy up on a ladder painting the ceiling, and it was Muddy Waters.
Right. Yeah.
A lot of the authentic fire in the belly white blues players have paid tribute suitably to people whose music it was. And I think that we need to address that because the feeling by the black community back in the 60s is we were stealing their music.
Which
and it was big
we were.
Time. So that, I think it's very appropriate to talk about it and see how it's resolved itself to the point where John Lee Hooker admits, or not admits, states unequivocally that Van Morrison is the best white blues player in the world. Those are words that should be taken seriously. And I see his statement as a resolution of that early conflict between white boys taking over the black people's music.
I'm not sure that there's a resolution. Mm-hmm. Maybe there is, but I think there's still a lot of work to do. One of the reasons why I would put Derek Trucks and Susan Tedeschi in my top tier of torchbearers is they have an earnest commitment to social justice, and they don't forget where that music came from. They pay homage to that every time they play.
That's true.
They're very mindful of all of that, and that's one reason why I favor them. So
I like the word that you used. People of the white race who play the blues, they pay homage.
Mm-hmm. Johnny Winter.
That's important. Johnny Winter, Stevie Ray, you know, on and on and on.
But Johnny, I think the thing that we're talking about now is core. The thing that Father Elk brought up in terms of the cultural exchange it's very complex. I mean, what that brought to my mind immediately, and you mentioned Keith Richards, and you know, did he steal the blues? Chuck Berry thought that he stole the blues. I mean, if you'll recall, famously, Keith Richards said to Chuck Berry on stage, "I've stolen all your licks," and Chuck Berry took a swing at him.
That's a true story. You just reminded me of a concert I went to in Salt Lake in the 80s. Chuck Berry remained a very, very angry man through most of his career.
That's true.
Mainly because of that.
Understandably so. You know, he went to prison on a trumped-up charge, probably. But, I mean, what a paradox that an albino saved the blues when the black folk, in terms of cultural experience at that point in time, didn't want the music. They were embarrassed by the music. It was the music of slavery.
And you're talking about Johnny Winter.
Johnny Winter. That, I mean, you have a guy who's not white, man. He is mega white, and he comes in and saves the blues. What a great cultural story.
When you got a good friend that'll stay right by your side. When you got a good friend that'll stay right by your side.
So one of the things that we've been saying is the blues is a very complicated and messy reflection of this complicated and messy country that we all live in that somehow resonates with everyone's inner suffering. And that's why we want to keep the blues alive. That's why it is still relevant. That's why we all will continue to listen to it probably till the day we die.
I would say that's fair. The only question that I would say remains is the relevancy question.
Is it relevant?
I think it remains interesting, worthy of praise. I think it remains enjoyable, without a doubt. But those feelings are shared by us in this room. And I think we have to acknowledge that there's a large part of the population that would completely disagree with us and that would say, what do you mean? This stuff is boring.
Perhaps that's another show.
Yeah.
Is it relevant? Maybe we need to go to the man and woman on the street and ask them if they find the blues relevant.
Yeah. I think the blues is a reflection of the human condition. The suffering, the joy, happiness, and how to translate that into greater popularity, like Father Elk was, I think, getting at. That is something that needs to be addressed, or else the music is going to die. And it's through people, younger people like Father Elk, that gives me hope that after I pass on and am playing tenor saxophone and Santana's Afterlife Band, that there's some dudes still left on the face of the earth playing the music.
You know, I did not come to the blues from the blues. I discovered the blues through rock and roll. It was Led Zeppelin, Rolling Stones, Deep Purple. That's how I discovered the blues.
And see, I discovered the blues through another interesting phenomenon, probably beyond our reach, which was late night all channel radio that
right,
existed
yeah.
in a point
sure.
in our country
Wolf
where you had
Man
a
Jack.
You, right, you
King
had a
Biscuit
half a dozen
hours.
Stations that were yeah. just booming all over the country. The rest of the radio went off at 10 o'clock, and those clear channel stations stayed on. And they had a huge influence on the music, and there's one of those, more than one of those, they were blues stations, some of them.
So now maybe a bigger question is radio still relevant?
I would say yes, and this is just from a very personal experience, but same deal, you know, I listened to rock and roll, I listened to Zeppelin and all those guys, and then got back into, you know, the Yardbirds and stuff, and just started going backwards and backwards, of course, but the primary reason that I got so devoted to it and very like invested in it and again almost this academic way was one Wednesday night blues program from Rice Radio in Houston that I got every single Wednesday night. The guy spun all vinyl. He did swamp pop, Gulf Coast blues, I mean, you know, like honky tonk sax stuff. Like just all and very, very deep cuts every single week. You know, it would be rare that you would hear a B.B. King song. Mm-hmm. And without that one program on that one radio station, which is now not on the air, mind you, it's now internet only, it was sold. Without that one program, I wouldn't have realized that this genre that I thought I had defined, you know, was hard-pressed to find a definition. Like, there's a whole spectrum of music out there that falls under the blues category, but he called his show Blues and Hi-Fi. Mm. And you heard it all. You heard Otis, you know, you heard Cookie and the Cupcakes, you heard everything that could fall under that umbrella. And that was what really hooked me on it. So, yeah, radio is a huge part to it now.
You was talking with another guy.
You know, when Cynthia and I go to music festivals, one of the questions that rests in the back of my mind is it a generational thing? And so at the festivals, I'm always looking at the audience, and I'm always looking at how many graybeards have we got versus folks who aren't. And I would say, just experientially, that it's graybeard-based at this point, that the predominant audience for the blues is probably over 45 or 50. But I'm also aware that there are certain artists that cut across that.
Crying on my shoulder. But let me tell you, baby.
You know, as we wind down our discussion here and we're talking about, you know, the generational component to interest in blues music, to the evolution of blues music. I think more and more as a young person, I realize, given the fact that I'm so young, there is such an endless world of music out there that I still don't know about just because I haven't been on this earth long enough to find it.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's any sort of hope for a continued or an evolved interest in blues as a form, as a feeling, as an experience of this country, it's just the simple fact that, like, there is stuff out there that has yet to be discovered by people my age who are interested in this music. There's always going to be stuff to be discovered, but there's also stuff out there that is still being dug up from the archives, you know? I mean, it's like I always say, we have stuff here on the vinyl shelves that wasn't reissued on CD. And there are master tapes out there of sessions in, you know, studios that weren't ever put to record. I mean, just constantly people are digging up older and older and deeper and deeper cut stuff that falls under this category of blues. And I think it's like that sort of excitement of the potential for new history in this music to be told that will continue drawing people into it, you know?
So I think it's safe to say that as long as the four of us have the wherewithal, we'll continue to do our best to keep the blues alive.
Sure.
All right.
Excellent.
Well, for Talkin' Music, I've been Cynthia Hines. I want to thank my panelists so much, Father Elk, Hurricane, and Todd. Thanks for tuning in to Talkin' Music on KVNF.
Gonna be your daddy, who gonna be your man, who gonna be your daddy, who gonna be your man. Tell me, what if you get down, like a yes, and fire grow them till like man.